5. Motion. What makes objects move? What paths do moving objects take? Medieval physicists, like physicists today, argued about their theories. They agreed on some points of their theories, but disagreed on others. They agreed that objects are set in motion by a force impressed into the objects, an internal momentum or impetus, and they agreed that objects remain in motion as long as their impetus has not been depleted, as noted in Chapter 1. But medieval physicists disagreed about whether impetus can take multiple forms and how it interacts with other physical forces. Some physicists believed that impetus dissipates on its own. Others believe that impetus remains in an object until depleted by external forces, like friction or air resistance. There were also differing opinions about when gravity affects impetus, from the moment an object is set in motion, or only after the object's impetus has dropped below a certain threshold. Some physicists theorized that carried objects acquire the impetus of their carriers, while others believe that carried objects acquired no impetus. Still other physicists debated whether impetus can induce curvilinear motion or only rectilinear motion. These disagreements had no resolution because impetus is not real. Arguing about whether impetus dissipates on its own is like arguing about whether gnomes wear hats. No experiment could ever settle the question because the question was ill-formed. The first person to recognize the futility of the question was Isaac Newton. In the Principia, Newton laid out three laws that forever changed our understanding of motion. 1. Objects in motion stay in motion unless acted on by an external force. 2. A force acting on a mass produces acceleration. And 3. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. These laws are no doubt familiar. Every physics student learns them, often in conjunction with canned illustrations. A ball rolling indefinitely on a frictionless surface, the first law. A block gaining speed as it slides down a ramp, the second law. Two cars recoiling in opposite directions after a collision, the third law. But what do these laws mean? How do they render the notion of impetus obsolete? Many of us have memorized Newton's laws and their corresponding equations, F equals ma, P equals mv. But we still rely on impetus for predicting and explaining motion in everyday life. One way to understand Newton's laws is by considering how those laws paint a different picture of motion than the picture we intuit on our own. Intuitively, we treat force and motion as inseparable. Force implies motion, and motion implies force. The prototypical force is a push or a pull. Either will set an object in motion. But what, then, keeps the object in motion? What maintains motion at a distance? Our intuition is that the force of our push or pull has been transferred to the object itself. Other factors, like gravity and friction, clearly affect an object's motion, but they appear to counteract motion rather than cause it, to redirect the object or to slow it down. We do not, therefore, think of gravity or friction as forces. We might call them forces, but we might think of them more as anti-forces. With Newton's theory, forces are reanalyzed from properties of objects themselves to interactions between objects. Forces can be applied to objects, but they cannot be imparted to objects. We intuitively connect force and motion, but Newton showed us that this connection is mistaken. Motion can exist in the absence of a force. Example, a comet traveling indefinitely through space. And a force can exist in the absence of motion. Example, a table pushing up on a plate, counteracting the force of gravity. Motion and force are dissociable because forces produce change in motion, where an object is going and how quickly, not motion itself. An object's velocity, speed and direction, is fundamentally different from its acceleration, change in speed or direction. Only acceleration requires force. As an illustration of the difference between our intuitive notion of force and a Newtonian notion, recall the thought experiment from Chapter 1. You imagined shooting a bullet parallel to the ground while dropping a second bullet from the same height. Most people think the dropped bullet will hit the ground before the shot bullet because they attribute an extra force to the shot bullet, the force of the gun impressed into the bullet itself. And this force is thought to counteract gravity for an initial moment or two. In reality, the difference in horizontal velocity between the shot bullet and the dropped bullet is a red herring. That difference has no effect on gravity, which pulls both bullets to the ground with the same acceleration. The shot bullet would simply cover more distance as it fell. By changing our understanding of force, Newton also changed our understanding of motion. We intuitively treat motion as distinct from rest. Motion is thought to require an explanation, but rest is not. And different types of motion, rising, falling, rotating, revolving, are thought to require different types of explanation. Newton, on the other hand, taught us that motion and rest are two sides of the same coin, inertia. Rest is just a way of describing a moving object whose motion has gone unnoticed. A book on a shelf may not be moving relative to us, but it is moving relative to the Earth's axis at 1,000 miles per hour and relative to the sun at 67,000 miles per hour. If motion requires explanation, then rest does too. But Newton showed us that motion does not require explanation. Only changes in motion require explanation. This point is well illustrated by the other thought experiment from Chapter 1, in which you imagine dropping a cannonball from the crow's nest of a speeding ship. Most people think the cannonball would land in the ship's wake rather than on the ship's deck, because we think the ship is in motion, but the cannonball is at rest. We envision the cannonball falling straight down while the ship moves out from beneath it. But the cannonball is moving at the same speed as the ship, and it falls forward at the same speed as well. If the cannonball example is not convincing, consider this real-world example, circulated on the Internet in the form of a mock inspirational poster. The poster features an 18-wheeler truck whose cab has been crushed by its cargo, a giant stone that heaved forward when the truck came to a sudden stop. The poster's caption reads, "Inertia, your truck has brakes, the massive hunk of stone doesn't." Nearly 350 years after Newton buried impetus theory in the graveyard of failed science, it remains alive and well in the minds of non-scientists. Impetus theory is the lens through which most of us interpret everyday instances of motion. Marbles rolling off tables, carts rolling down hills, bombs dropped from planes, bullets shot from guns, balls kicked at goals, lassos flung at targets, coins tossed into the air. We use impetus theory to predict the trajectory of a moving object, to diagram the forces acting on a moving object, and even to interact with moving objects in real time. No matter the task or the context, impetus theory reigns supreme. Take the task of drawing the predicted trajectory of a moving object. Many studies have used this task to diagnose whether our intuitive beliefs about motion align more closely with impetus theory or with reality. Participants are given a diagram of an object in motion, say a marble rolling toward the end of a table, and are asked to complete the diagram by drawing what will happen next. In reality, a marble that rolls off a table will fall to the ground in a fully parabolic path, a path produced by the combination of its horizontal velocity and its downward acceleration due to gravity. Most participants, however, draw non-parabolic paths. They draw paths that are parallel to the ground at their beginning or perpendicular to the ground at their end. They appear to believe that the marble has acquired an impetus that will keep it aloft at the beginning of its fall, similar to the shot bullet, or that will be overcome by gravity at the end of its fall. In another version of the task, participants are asked to draw the path of a bomb dropped from a moving plane. The bomb would follow a fully parabolic path in real life, just like the marble, but most participants predict the bomb would fall straight down. They appear to believe that the plane is in motion, but the bomb is at rest. And they do not, therefore, grant it any horizontal velocity, similar to the dropped cannonball. Perhaps the most blatant demonstration of a covert belief in impetus comes from tasks in which participants are asked to draw the expected trajectories of objects accelerated along curved paths, like a ball shot through a curved tube or a ball swung on a string like a lasso and then released. Such objects would travel in a straight path tangent to the curved path at the point of their release, but many participants predict that the objects will continue to travel in a curve. They appear to believe that objects accelerated along curved paths will maintain those paths even in the absence of external forces, the surface force of the tube or the tension force of the string. The participants' drawings make sense only from the perspective of impetus theory, because only an impetus could propel an object along a curved path in the absence of external forces. What's more, this inference flies in the face of everyday counterexamples, like water pouring from a coiled garden hose or bullets shot through a looped rifle barrel. In one study, participants were asked to draw those events, and they correctly surmised that water pumped through a coiled garden hose would exit in a straight line, as would bullets shot through a looped rifle barrel. But when participants were then asked to draw the path of a ball shot through a curved tube, they drew curved paths. Reminding participants of analogous, real-world situations had no effect on their impetus-based patterns of reasoning, which they deployed by default to the novel situation. In another task that reveals impetus-based patterns of reasoning, participants are shown a moving object and asked to draw the forces acting on that object, depicting them as arrows. Quite often, participants draw the impetus itself. When shown the trajectory of a coin toss, for instance, many participants draw two forces acting on the coin at all times, the downward force of gravity and an upward force described by participants as the force of the coin or the coin's momentum, pseudonyms for impetus. On the coin's ascent, the upward force is depicted as larger than the downward force. At the object's apex, the two forces are depicted as equal. On the object's descent, the upward force is depicted as smaller than the downward force. It is clear from such drawings that participants believe that an impetus is transferred to the coin when it is tossed into the air, and that the impetus wanes over the course of its trajectory. The tipping point between impetus and gravity is the point at which the coin stops moving upward and starts moving downward. Our intuition that motion implies a force leads us to posit a force that doesn't actually exist. In reality, though, gravity is the only force that acts on the coin at all points in its trajectory. The speed of its ascent decreases until it has no upward velocity, at which point it begins to accelerate downward. On the other hand, when it comes to drawing the forces acting on a stationary object, participants rarely draw a force that actually does exist, the upward force of a supporting surface, known to physicists as the normal force. Rest does not intuitively imply a force in the way that motion does, but a force must exist. Otherwise, the stationary object would be pulled through the supporting surface by gravity. In studies where participants are asked to draw the trajectories of moving objects or the forces acting on those objects, researchers often ask participants to explain their drawings. The participants rarely refer to impetus in their explanations, at least not by name. Instead, they describe something that plays the role of impetus but is identified in more familiar terms: momentum, internal energy, internal force, force of motion. Consider the following explanations, all provided by college undergraduates in interviews about physical motion. The momentum from the curve of the tube gives the ball an arc. The force that the ball picks up from the curve eventually dissipates, and it will follow a normal straight line. The force from the moving ball would be transferred to the stationary ball, so the force would move from the moving ball to the ball that wasn't moving. This ball, now that it's traveling, has a certain amount of force. The moving object has the force of momentum, and since there's no force to oppose that force, it will continue on until it is opposed by something. These explanations mirror those provided by medieval physicists, as noted in Chapter 1. One such physicist, Jean Buridan, explained projectile motion as follows. In moving, a moving body impresses in it a certain impetus or a certain force in the direction toward which the mover was moving the body, either up or down, or laterally, or circularly. It is by that impetus that the stone is moved after the projector ceases to move it. But that impetus is continually decreased by the resisting air and by the gravity of the stone. Even Newton once explained projectile motion in terms of impetus. In a notebook dated 1664, a college-age Newton wrote that motion is not continued by a force impressed from the outside, because the force must be communicated from the mover into the moved. Newton would eventually abandon the idea that a force must be communicated from the mover into the moved, but it was the starting point for his studies of motion, as it is for all of us. And lest you think that impetus theory is a trite idea, a mistaken belief with no obvious consequence, studies have shown that impetus theory influences how we interact with real three-dimensional objects. In one study, participants were given a golf ball and asked to drop it on a target as they walked quickly past the target, like a plane dropping a bomb. Most participants released the ball directly over the target, neglecting the ball's horizontal velocity and thereby overshooting the target. They assumed the ball had no impetus of its own and would fall straight down. Only participants who released the ball before the target were actually successful. They hit the target because the ball fell forward in a parabolic arc, similar to a cannonball's path when the ball is dropped from the crow's nest of a moving ship. In another task, participants were given a hockey puck and asked to glide the puck through a curved tube. Many participants accelerated the puck along a curved path before releasing it, as if trying to impart a curved impetus. They missed. The only way to succeed at the task was to send the puck on a straight path tangent to the center of the curved tube. Our interactions with physical objects are not always afflicted by impetus. An experienced hockey player, for instance, would never attempt to curve a puck by accelerating it along a curved path, because hockey players have learned how pucks actually move. Likewise, experienced baseball players would never position themselves under the apex of a fly ball, expecting the ball to fall straight down into their glove, and an experienced soccer player would never kick a passed ball perpendicular to the direction of the pass, expecting the force of the kick to overpower the ball's existing velocity. We can learn to interact with moving objects in optimal ways, but our first instincts are suboptimal, based on impetus rather than inertia. When we draw the path of a marble rolling off a table as momentarily parallel to the ground, we are drawing the path that Wile E. Coyote takes when chasing the Roadrunner off a cliff in a Looney Tunes cartoon. Our expectation for the marble is bizarre, given that we are not fooled by the cartoon. We know that Wile E. Coyote should fall the moment he steps off the cliff. That's why we find it amusing when he does not. Impetus-based trajectories are only plausible on paper. As soon as we watch them unfold before our eyes, we easily recognize them as unnatural and cartoonish. People who have had their brains monitored while they watch Wile E. Coyote-esque animations show evidence of detecting the unnatural motion within 300 milliseconds of its occurrence. We detect unnatural motion even before we can reflect on what it is we saw. our perceptual expectations about motion turn out to be far more accurate than our conceptual expectations. For instance, if asked to indicate which of several paths a ball would take when shot through a curved tube, we correctly favor a straight path over a curved path if the potential paths are animated. But if those paths are presented as static drawings, we incorrectly favor a curved path over a straight path. Likewise, if asked which of several paths a ball would take when swung like a pendulum and released at its apex, where it has no velocity, we correctly favor a straight path over a curved path if the potential paths are animated, and incorrectly favor a curved path over a straight path if the paths are presented as static drawings. This dissociation between perceptual and conceptual expectations has been observed even in children. In one study, elementary schoolers were asked to consider the path a ball would take if it were dropped from a hot air balloon flying parallel to the ground. One group of children predicted whether the ball would fall forward, backward, or straight down. A second group of children watched the ball fall along each of those paths and judged which path was correct. Almost none of the children in the first group predicted that the ball would fall forward, but most children in the second group recognized that a forward-falling path is the correct path. Even two-year-olds show a dissociation between perceptual and conceptual expectations about motion. If two-year-olds are shown an animation of a ball falling straight down as it rolls off a table, they are surprised. They stare reliably longer at a ball that falls straight down than at a ball that falls in a parabolic path. Nevertheless, when children of this age are asked to predict where a ball will land after rolling off a table, they predict it will land directly below the table, even though they would be surprised to see the ball actually land there. The fact that two-year-olds make impetus-based predictions implies that they construct an impetus theory of motion quite early in life, long before they've learned the words motion or force. And the fact that two-year-olds make these predictions despite their ability to recognize unnatural motion in animations implies that our conceptual expectations about motion are partitioned from our perceptual expectations from the very start. One compelling demonstration of this partition comes from studies of motion-based memory. In one set of studies, college-aged participants watched a ball exit a curved tube along a straight path and were asked to draw what they just saw. Most participants misremembered having seen the ball exit the tube along a curved path. In another study, participants watched as two balls, one large and one small, were launched into the air at the same speed. The balls ascended and descended in unison, but participants misremembered having seen the small ball ascend quicker than the large one, as if the small ball was less affected by gravity. In these studies, it has also been found that the longer we hold the experience in memory, the more these illusions become etched in our minds. The additional time allows our conceptual expectations to more fully override our perceptual ones. We may recognize the veracity of Newton's laws when perceiving motion, but that recognition is as brief as sight itself. Impetus theory is constructed early in life and persists despite our ability to perceive motion accurately in real time. Is there any way to move beyond impetus theory? Have educators devised ways of imparting a more Newtonian view of motion? Most educators use problem sets to teach Newton's laws, but problem sets do not help students change their conceptions. One study makes this point crystal clear. Researchers recruited physics students who had received 4.5 hours of physics instruction per week per year for 2 years. The students had solved hundreds, if not thousands, of physics problems throughout their instruction. To determine whether solving all those problems was helpful, the researchers gave the students a test of their conceptual understanding of motion, a test designed to differentiate impetus-based reasoning from Newtonian reasoning, and compared their scores with the total number of physics problems they had solved. the results were disappointing. Students who had solved 3,000 problems were just as likely to deploy impetus-based reasoning as students who had solved only 300. Solving thousands of physics problems may not increase your understanding of motion, but it does have one tangible benefit. It makes you better at solving physics problems. You learn how to map abstract equations to concrete situations, to recognize which equations apply to which situations. At no point, however, are you required to ponder the meaning of those equations. You just plug and chug. Plug the right numbers into the right equations and chug through the math. If problem sets are ineffective at improving our understanding of motion, what kinds of activities are effective? Many physics education researchers have suggested that microworlds are the answer. Microworlds are virtual environments in which students are taught the laws of physics through simulated interactions and simulated experiments. These activities have several attractive features from an educational point of view. They can instantiate any laws of physics, not just Newtonian laws. They can simulate any physical interaction, not just the kind that can be staged in a classroom. And they can measure any physical parameter, not just the kind that can be measured with a stopwatch or a tape measure. The things that can be studied in a microworld far outstrip those that can be studied in the boring old real world. Microworlds may be attractive, but are they effective? Researchers in one study looked at this question using the popular video game Enigmo. In Enigmo, players redirect falling droplets of water from one part of the microworld to another by manipulating where they fall. The droplets conform to Newtonian principles, including the notoriously misunderstood principle that projectiles travel along parabolic paths. The participants in the study were middle schoolers. Half played Enigmo for 6 hours over the course of a month, and the other half played a strategy game that did not involve any physics, Railroad Tycoon, for the same amount of time. Both groups concluded the study by completing a 39-minute tutorial on Newtonian principles. The researchers measured participants' conceptual understanding of motion at 3 times, before playing the video games, after playing the video games, and after completing the physics tutorial. As predicted, those who played Enigmo increased their score from the first test to the second, but they did so by only 5%. The physics tutorial, on the other hand, boosted scores by 20%, and students who played Railroad Tycoon profited from the tutorial as much as did the students who played Enigmo. In other words, a 30-minute tutorial on Newtonian principles proved several times more effective than a 6-hour excursion into a microworld that instantiated those same principles. Similar results have been obtained using other kinds of microworlds. At best, microworlds are no better than standard instruction. At worst, they are a waste of time, yielding knowledge that cannot be generalized beyond the confines of the game. In many ways, it's a blessing that we do not generalize the knowledge acquired in microworlds to real-world contexts, because the microworlds contained in popular video games rarely instantiate Newtonian principles. They instantiate whatever principles make the game most enjoyable for their players. Take Nintendo's Super Mario Brothers. Mario and his brother Luigi do not retain their horizontal velocity when they jump off moving platforms. They jump straight up, with the platforms moving out from underneath them. And when objects fall off moving platforms, they fall straight down. Some objects are subject to gravity, and some are not. And gravity in general works inconsistently, allowing Mario to jump twice his height, but then fall 8 times faster than he should, given the speed of his ascent. Of course, no one who plays Super Mario Brothers thinks that they can jump twice their height just because Mario can. We quarantine that knowledge, applying it to Mario's world only, just as students who play Enigmo quarantine whatever knowledge of Newtonian principles they happen to acquire from the game. Perhaps microworlds have proven educationally ineffective because they provide students with virtual experiences, and such experiences are too indirect. Many educators believe that knowledge gained from indirect experiences, video games, documentaries, lectures, textbooks, pales in comparison to the knowledge gained from direct hands-on experiences. Hands-on experiences have a tangible, authentic quality that many believe is critical for meaningful engagement and long-term retention. This belief has not been supported by research, however. Several studies have shown that hands-on experiences are no more effective than hands-off experiences, that is, instruction, at teaching abstract ideas like Newtonian principles. The problem is that abstract ideas need to be abstracted before they can be learned, and hands-on experiences are not suited for that purpose. Education researcher Maggie Rankin conducted a study that nicely demonstrates the ineffectiveness of hands-on experiences. She and her colleagues compared hands-on and hands-off approaches to teaching that all objects fall at the same rate, regardless of their mass. The participants were two groups of middle school students. One group conducted a series of experiments with balls and ramps. The students systematically manipulated the incline of the ramp and the mass of the ball to determine which variables affect the ball's speed as it rolls down a ramp. The other group read about those experiments, the methods, the results, the implications, but did not actually conduct any experiments themselves. At the conclusion of the study, only the latter group learned that objects fall at the same rate regardless of mass. Watching balls of different mass fall at the same rate down a ramp had no effect on students' prior belief that large objects fall faster than small ones. On the other hand, telling students that balls of different mass fall at the same rate did have an effect. Those students were able to recall and apply the principle not only the day it was taught, but also 3 months later. On first blush, these results are surprising. Why would students be more receptive to second-hand information about a physical principle than first-hand observation of that principle in action? On reflection, however, these results make a lot of sense. If exposure to physical principles was sufficient for learning those principles, then all of us would learn them on our own, before being introduced to the principles in school. But cognitive biases, like the perception that motion is distinct from rest, or the perception that motion implies a force, lead us to overlook these principles in everyday life. And our biases lead us to overlook these principles when we are running our own hands-on experiments as well. From a historical point of view, it's ridiculous to think that students would discover the laws of motion for themselves in a 30-minute experiment when it took physicists hundreds of years of observation and experimentation to discover them. That said, hands-on experiences with physical objects are not worthless. Given the right instructional methods, they can serve as powerful inroads to learning. One such method has been devised by education researcher John Clement. The key to Clement's method is analogy. Rather than expose students to physical systems and merely hope they discover the principles that underlie those systems, Clement directs students' attention toward these principles through the use of structured comparisons or analogies. Take Clement's method for teaching the counterintuitive idea that surfaces, like tables and counters, exert an upward force on the objects they support, the normal force. Most of us don't acknowledge that a table pushes up on a book, but most of us do acknowledge that a spring pushes up on a hand. Clement calls the latter an anchoring intuition, that is, a correct intuition to which an incorrect intuition can be compared and then revised. The knowledge that a spring pushes up on a hand does not by itself help a person understand how a table pushes up on a book. The conceptual gap between a hand on a spring and a book on a table is too great. But that gap can be traversed with what Clement calls bridging cases. A book on a spring, followed by a book on a thick piece of foam, followed by a book on a flexible piece of plywood, followed ultimately by a book on a table. With each step, from spring to foam, foam to plywood, and plywood to table, we are willing to infer an upward force where we had been unwilling to infer one before. The bridging culminates in the inference that even tables must exert an upward force on the objects they support. Bridging activities can be used to convey other counterintuitive ideas as well. To convey the idea that all surfaces exert friction, even smooth surfaces like ceramic or steel, we could start with the anchoring intuition of rubbing one piece of sandpaper against another, and then move to bridging cases like rubbing one piece of corduroy against another, or rubbing one piece of felt against another. To convey the idea that satellites orbit planets because their path is continuously curved by the planet's gravity, we could start with the anchoring intuition of a cannonball falling in an arc as it is shot horizontally from a tower, and then move to bridging cases in which the cannonball is shot from higher and higher towers and thus falls in longer and longer arcs. With enough height and enough speed, the cannonball would arc indefinitely, encircling the Earth rather than falling to its surface. Bridging analogies like this last one, first described by Newton in A Treatise of the System of the World, can be quite poetic. They render the counterintuitive intuitive and the imperceptible perceptible. Not surprisingly, then, they have proven highly effective. Clement has compared lessons with bridging analogies and those without them, and has found that lessons with bridging analogies are nearly twice as effective at teaching counterintuitive physical principles as are those without them. By linking opaque manifestations of physical principles to more transparent ones, a bridging analogy allows us to glean from experience the principles we would otherwise overlook. The success of Clement's bridging analogies raises questions about the nature of our preconceptions. Should preconceptions be viewed as obstacles to learning science or as resources for learning it? Clement's view is the latter. In a paper blatantly titled, "Not All Preconceptions Are Misconceptions," he argues that the resource view and the obstacles view have different implications for how we should teach science. According to the resource view, preconceptions should be highlighted and used as bridges to more complex ideas. According to the obstacle view, they should be dismantled or sidestepped. We have encountered examples of both types of strategies in previous chapters. In Chapter 3, we encountered a strategy for teaching students about heat. The strategy sidestepped their substance-based conceptions by introducing an alternative, emergent process framework for thinking about heat. In Chapter 2, on the other hand, we encountered a strategy for teaching students about matter by bridging their undifferentiated conceptions of weight and density to a scientific per-unit conception of those properties. Is one strategy inherently better than the other? Education researchers are deeply divided on this question. Some are concerned mainly about what is effective in the classroom, whereas others are concerned about broader epistemological issues as well. Education researcher Andrea DeSessa believes that labeling preconceptions misconceptions is uncharitable to the students who hold the preconceptions. In one paper, he notes that he has attended too many talks where researchers deride or even ridicule students' knowledge, using deprecating terms such as pseudo-concepts and comparing them to ignorance or backwardness. This practice is wrong, he believes, because many naive ideas actually become part of high-quality technical competence. The rich, naive cognitive ecology constitutes a generative pool of resources. Just as sub-conceptual elements can combine to create the impetus theory, better combinations of those or different elements are possible. DeSessa's view may be charitable to novice learners, but it glosses over the reality of their preconceptions. Some preconceptions really are misconceptions. Heavy objects do not fall faster than lighter ones. Projectiles are not subject to more forces than are objects at rest. Objects dropped from moving vehicles do not fall straight down. And objects shot through curved tubes do not trace curved paths. What unites these misconceptions, across contexts, across people, across development, and across history, is that they are grounded in the belief that objects can acquire a fictitious force, impetus. Impetus is not an inaccurate combination of otherwise accurate ideas. It is the root of our inaccurate ideas. Denying that impetus-based beliefs are misconceptions is tantamount to ignoring the empirical research on those beliefs. On the other hand, acknowledging that impetus-based beliefs are misconceptions is not tantamount to claiming that all preconceptions are misconceptions. Clement's bridging analogies are effective because they make use of preconceptions that clearly are not misconceptions, preconceptions that have avoided the taint of impetus, probably because they defy an impetus-based interpretation. Given the diversity of our preconceptions, the debate over whether preconceptions should be viewed as obstacles or as resources is a false start. Some of our preconceptions are accurate, and some are not. And the question of which are accurate and which are inaccurate is an empirical one. We cannot know how accurate our preconceptions are unless we investigate how those preconceptions influence our reasoning. Likewise, we cannot know how effective a particular instructional strategy is until we put it to the test. Sometimes, sidestepping and bridging are not mutually exclusive strategies. Each achieves something different, yet complementary. The bridging strategy renders counterintuitive scientific ideas, say the normal force, intuitive, but does not explain those ideas, either in terms of an underlying mechanism, molecular bonds, or an overarching framework, Newton's third law. The sidestepping strategy, on the other hand, provides a framework for explaining counterintuitive scientific ideas, but does not render them intuitive. Educators might thus want to use both strategies in the same lesson, as Clement recommends they should. The world is a complex place, and acquiring an accurate understanding of that world is a complex process.